Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
The new washing machine is going.
Oh.
So I hope exciting. Everybody who tracks my appliances on the Six Colors podcast enjoys that. We have today an answer to a very important philosophical question, which is, who is more powerful, Cal and Dar or the T-Robot?
Oh.
And the answer is, we started late because I was getting my tea.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I was, you know, we were discussing when to record, and you're like, I'm going to make some tea, and I'm like, oh, tea.
Mm.
But then I didn't have enough time, I boiled I used the water boiling feature and poured it into, a tea filter, so I have tea mid-steep in front
mid-steep.
Of me.
Mid-steep, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm waiting.
I didn't call you until the beep, and I was able to get my tea, so I have freshly boiled, dispensed robot tea.
Oh man, tea is great.
Tea's pretty good. Welcome to our new tea podcast.
I'm here for the tea.
It's on the list of podcasts that I will never do, that it would be fun to do, but I will never do. Somebody asked me on Twitter today, a very nice person who's going to England, and asked me if I had, it was an ask upgrade, so we might even talk about it on Monday, if I had any travel suggestions for England, which is funny because, you know, Mike actually lives there and probably has better recommendations than me. But as an American...
Curly.
And he's going to Harrogate, which means that he'll be in Yorkshire, which means like York is great and Yorkminster is great to visit, and you can get a good proper Yorkshire pudding there, and you can go, now we're a travel podcast, and you can go up into the Yorkshire Dales, which especially, like, I grew up on All Creatures Great and Small, so to drive through the actual Yorkshire Dales and see all these places that, like, literally these bridges and towns and stuff that I remember from the TV show.
Right,
That's great. And I had other recommendations, but, and his response was, have you ever thought about doing a travel podcast? And the answer is no, for several reasons, one of which is there are so many other things that I'm better at, and also, must every pleasure I take in life be converted into a podcast?
It does feel like that sometimes.
Maybe the answer is yes, Dan. Oh, yeah. No. Calendar got me.
I was listening back to a little bit of the episode I recorded of Anthony Johnson's new podcast. And at one point, he's like, what do you do to relax? And I had that realization of like, oh, no, I've converted all of my hobbies into jobs.
Uh-huh.
That was a mistake. Oops.
I was talking to Lauren about... the Doctor Who finale was on Sunday, and for those who don't know, in my other life as a pop culture podcaster,
who listening to this show does not know that?
I don't know. Some people don't care about that. They just care about the computers, and that's fine. That's fine. Like, I was thinking, other people have enthusiasms, and they just are never, they never surface in their professional work. And I've never really allowed that to happen for me, which is kind of funny. It's just a decision, I guess, I made. It's like, this is fun. Let's try it out. But, I was talking to Lauren about this because the Doctor Who finale was Sunday, and I've been going through this period where I was doing two podcasts a week about that are the weekly, watch and review podcasts for Star Trek Picard and for Doctor Who. And, it's a lot of work, and Lauren and I were talking, and she's like, yeah, it's kind of nice to watch a TV show and not actually have it be... Now, I mean, like, I have to watch it right away. I have to take notes. Then I probably, if it's a show we watch together, and both of those we do, I will watch it again later. So I have to watch it twice. So that's 2 hours out of the day instead of just one. And it's one of those things where some stuff I take great pleasure in, and I'm just going to refrain from turning it into something else because I just kind of want to treasure it. And that, like I was talking to Max Temkin at one point about how he and I are both, like, he's really into Survivor, and I love Survivor, and I'm watching Survivor again after not taking some years off from it. And, like, I can see what that podcast would be. That would be great. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it because it's like, I'm not going to do it. It's too much. So I pick my spots is what I'm saying. But because, you can convert all that stuff, convert your hobbies. It's great to convert your hobbies into things that you kind of do. Like, that's always been the case for me, that the people say, well, what do you write and stuff like that, and work for a magazine. What's your hobby? And it's like, well, I have an internet magazine that I do. It's like, oh, another one. Yeah, well, and then, you know, I like sci-fi stuff, and I made a podcast where I do that now. Like, it's just, I rolled all of it into other things, and, you know, there's a limit to that. So, no, I don't think a tea podcast or a travel podcast is in my future, because,
give me
something. Let me have something.
my hobby used to be writing fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And now you get paid a small amount to do
again,
it. Like most
seems like it should
novelists.
Be way better, and yet it's still
no, but it's
still
good.
It's still a job.
It is. It is. I mean, having deadlines makes it a job. I mean, that I sometimes think that's the difference that calling it like a hobby or a job or a jobby or a hob, if you like, do that.
Don't do that. That seems bad.
I think that the real distinction might be between like doing it on a self-imposed or really imposed deadline. I don't know. Sometimes I think the distinction is, you can do it or not, and you meander and all of that. But that may just be about personality types, that some people are like, I'm gonna make a chair, and they're like, I got a plan. I'm going to do this part this day, this part this week, and by April 24th, the chair will be done. And other people are like, yeah, that chair, that half-made chair over there, been working on that for a couple of years.
Yep.
I don't know. I mean, that for me, that's sort of the distinction I've gone with, is there's like these podcasts and stuff where it's like, you have to do it. And then there's stuff that's like, I can do it or not. And for you, like when you're writing these novels now, you've got like deadlines and stuff, and it's different.
I mean, sometimes though,
sometimes.
That's the weird thing. The weird thing is that it's not, for example, right now, I have no books under contract right now.
Right. You're an unemployed novelist, except you have a book coming out, so you're not. But yeah.
But it's still like there's no deadline for me to write another book. But if I don't write another book, I will never get
You'll
paid
never,
for another
never,
book.
Never be a novelist again. Yeah, exactly.
So that's a weird position to be in, because it's not like a job where something is demanded of me right now. The only demand is from myself at this point, and saying I would like to write another book.
Right.
And that needs to start with, actually writing it.
When I was visiting my mom in Arizona, she said to me, I just don't think she does this every now and then. She's like, I just don't think I could do that, to have, because she's trying to understand my job. And it's like, I do stuff and I have to like choose when to do stuff. And it's just, I do whatever I do whenever I do it. And she's just like, I don't think, and I said, it's not for everyone. Like you do, some people do not work well in that kind of environment, and that you have to know that about yourself. Cause for you to be a novelist, you have to be the motivator of yourself and have a structure and have a plan. And I know that it can be loosey goosey at times, but ultimately that you need to write a novel.
End of the day, nobody's going to make me do it but myself. Right.
Yeah.
Like there is no external force that is brought to bear on me that is going to force me to do that. I have to make, whereas, I do podcasts and I do tech pieces and stuff like that. And all that has an external scaffolding on it. It's like, all right, got to turn in a column this week. Got to write a pod, got to do a podcast.
Clarifying to have a deadline, but you otherwise have. So I'm working on a couple of medium ish term projects right now. And the challenge I have is getting them up and running, and getting a schedule for them, because they're not, I talked about this with David a long time ago on Free Agents when that was a podcast. It is, getting a project up and running can be really hard, and you have to kind of create that scaffolding. Cause even if you know what the finished project is, it's like, okay, I have 1,000 tasks to do. And let's say I give myself 3 months to do it. But like, it's 1,000 unordered tasks, and you start to go, okay, well, maybe this is a group that has to happen at the end, and this is a group that has to happen. But like, you still end up with hundreds of ways you could start.
Right.
And for me, that is the hardest thing, is figuring out how the scaffolding works and getting it cranked up. And I've been doing that the last few weeks, and it's really hard, because I don't want to waste effort, because there's nothing worse than spending a day working on something and then throw it away, right? Where you're like, oh no, that was no good.
It happens, but
it does happen. And sometimes it has to, right? Sometimes you have to try it and go, nope, that's not, what not to do is the lesson I learned today. And that's an important lesson, and I wasted a day. I didn't really waste it, but I kind of wasted it. So, it's a challenge, but that you have to do it, because I don't have somebody to say, okay, Jason, I've worked on this kind of project before. Here's your deadlines. Hit them, which would be great. Honestly, if somebody came to me and said, you got this project, here's your schedule. Like a managing editor. You remember back in the day?
Yep. Yep.
At Macworld, like, we had a managing editor. And I remember back at MacUser, Claire, once Hamilton, then Breen, Chris Breen's wife, she was our managing editor for years at MacUser, and Macworld, actually, too, in the early days. And she had, like, an Excel file that she'd print out that had, like, a grid with all the stories on it, and, like, into copy edit, back from copy edit, final. And it's so I always thought that was so great because I knew exactly what was expected of me. And without that, I don't have that whip cracker. Nor do I have the spreadsheet. Like what even are the boxes on the spreadsheet? Right. It's a challenge.
Some people are really great at that mindset. And that's,
oh man. And bless those people. Bless
yes,
those people.
Exactly. I am not that person. I am 100% not that person. But I value them.
I'm a spreadsheet maker. I mean, I do have them. Like for the incomparable, I have the whole incomparable planning thing, and I do that. But I think the real challenge is somebody has to build the structure. And if there's nobody to do it but you, then you have to do it, and that's kind of hard. So I guess that's what I'm saying is the structure thing. Can be a challenge when we're actually this is a segue as kind of solo people. I'm thinking of writing a piece about this. I haven't decided whether I'm going to do it or not, but with the virus stuff going on, I mean, COVID-19, and there's like different ways that you can describe the coronavirus is the colloquial, but it's like there's the virus, and then there's the sickness that comes from the virus if you get the sickness and are infected. It's a lot. There's complexity here. But the bigger picture is we may be entering a period where a bunch of stuff that we just sort of take as how the reality of life in 2020 is going to change. Like conferences are being canceled. I just saw the University of Washington is shutting down the classrooms, and they're going to have everybody do remote learning because they don't want the students going and mingling even more. And there's a question of like, okay, I've got a kid who's in college and is going to be coming home for spring break, and like, are they going to say don't come back? Are they what is going on here? And I was thinking about that, but I was thinking of it in the context of work, because separately I was talking to some people about tech companies, you know, doing the you should work from home kind of thing, which a lot of the Silicon Valley companies are definitely talking about. And
yeah,
I
was supposed to go to Seattle next week, which I don't think is happening. But I was going to stay with a friend who works for Microsoft, and he told me last week. Yeah, he's like, "Yep, we're working from home.
Working from home." Yeah. So I was thinking about that in the context, and this is what I would write about: is in the context of some companies still insisting that people be in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know people who've gotten hired at Apple and they have jobs. I actually just talked to somebody who's a parent of kids at my son's school, and we've known for a while. And she used to work at Apple until like a few months ago. And what she said was, oh, yeah, we got a new boss. And the new boss said everybody needs to be in the office 5 days a week. And she lives in Marin County, where I live, and it's too far. And she was coming in 2 days a week or something like that. And I thought, it's not at all the first time I've heard somebody say that about Apple, that there are certain tasks at Apple that you just can't do outside of Apple Park.
Right.
And I you know, part of it is security, and I get that part. Like, you don't want proprietary data or code or anything leaving the campus, because then you don't know what's going to happen to it. But it always, because you were an employee at Macworld and did not work in the office, right?
Like, indeed.
We had a lot of them, and I keep thinking about it and wondering if this virus thing will change anybody's attitudes here, because we had such a talented staff at Macworld because in part we hired very talented people who we worked with who didn't live locally, but it didn't matter because they were really good and we hired them. And that was
so much of the workflow of stuff we were doing, we had the tools to be able to do that remotely, and it didn't matter as
much. Some stuff, like Jim in the lab, like he was testing hardware and stuff. Like, you can't not, like, unless he had all the hardware at his house or something, it's not practical. But so much of there are jobs that are like that, and there are jobs that aren't. And and our friend James Thompson, you know, he was basically given an ultimatum back in the Steve Jobs era of move to Cupertino or quit Apple. And he was working on OS 10, and he quit.
He took the middle route for a while.
Then he lied about where he lived for a while, and then he finally was found out, and he left and moved back to Scotland from Cork, Ireland. I guess my point is, I think my overarching point is that companies talk about the need to have people in the office, way more than they actually need them in the office. And maybe they'll learn some lessons from the virus spread here. One, that they don't need to be in the office as much, but two, that it also provides a resilience if we're entering an era where this kind of stuff happens. Because I learned as a senior manager that one of the biggest motivators for work from home policies is there's some boss somewhere who knows how much they're paying for rent and they want to see people use the space. And I always thought it would be better to have a smaller space and give people credit to go work at a co-working facility if they want. I know that not everybody has a work from home space, and I want, you know, the truth is some people can't work from home, but it bugs me to this day that these supposedly forward thinking companies, including Apple, still get hung up on like stuff like the App Store, the people who write articles and edit articles for the App Store. This is not confidential information for the most part, or certainly not highly confidential information. It's like that's an in Cupertino job. Like you can't, if you had the best writer or editor in the world who would work for way cheaper than the cost of living in Cupertino and was in Wyoming, they wouldn't hire them. They just wouldn't, because they don't do that. Right. And that's it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the other part of the equation, is so many of these companies are based in places now that have these housing crises, right? Like, well, and
that makes it a lot worse, right? That this is not a place you can afford to live, but you have to live here.
But it also, and moreover, and I'm not going to go out and say those companies should pay less, but what you could argue is if you are hiring people who do not live in that area, and thus you do not have to maintain a standard of living, you have a larger range of pay scales to work with.
Yeah, you can save a lot of money. You can save a lot of money hiring a programmer in Pittsburgh over a programmer in Silicon Valley.
Sure.
Even if they supply the same amount of value, because the cost of living is so different.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, I think this is I think, you know, the other part of this that we've been looking at obviously a lot this week is the canceling of large events. And certainly outside the financial impact there, I think going back to what you said a moment ago, this is not the last time you're going to have to deal with this problem. I think that is something that not everybody's come to grips with yet, but I think that, you know, this is an indicator and this is something you need to now plan for going forward. And, and this affects so many things. Like, I was talking to my wife about this yesterday, and my wife, you know, she has an MBA. She studied a lot of this stuff. And she's like, you know, the health crisis, obviously, that's bad. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of risk there. And,
sure,
you know, we have to have a healthcare system that supports these people, et cetera. But she's like, I'm really worried about the supply chains, like, because I think that's really hard to come back from. And we have only started to scratch the surface because of the fact it works at a delay. Like, we have not seen the full impact of that yet.
Right. You could argue
that is going to be damning.
You could argue that hardening the supply chain is actually a little bit easier because, you know, in factories and things like that, they may be able to do it. Although, again, having it be distributed more so that if one
area
gets out of whack. Well, Ben Thompson wrote a piece this week where he mentioned sort of as an aside that there are, I forget what product it is, Apple Watch, you know, AirPods. It's AirPods. They're making the AirPods Pro in Vietnam and not in China. And part of that is because they want to diversify. And part of it is that the industrial capabilities in Vietnam are not as strong as they are in China now. And the AirPods Pro is a glued together product, which means it's easier to assemble. Well, but still, it's diversifying the supply chain and the production line.
Yeah. And that's the challenge, is that, like, China and specifically, you know, those assembly firms there have made such a science out of the manufacturing, right? That, like, they have a huge advantage. Not only in that, but also in, you know, with all the downsides that comes with that, the labor population there, like, and the cost of labor, it's hard to compete with that. But even if you think, well, this is great, like, we can put all our manufacturing there and we will save so much money because it's all centralized and, like, it's got this labor force that's primed for this and it's not that expensive. The problem is you've, again, essentially put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
So if something happens, which it just did, then you have to deal with that. And obviously they've had to deal with this in other ways, too. There's been a lot of reports about Apple trying to do manufacturing in India because that's a requirement, I believe, of selling some devices in India. And of course, there are challenges like bootstrapping a manufacturing process there because it's not the same environment as it is in China. And, you know, obviously they've looked, I think they have some facilities in Brazil too, and other places.
Sure.
And, like, you know, and obviously there's the Mac Pro assembly plant in Texas. But Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because they've spent, you know, Tim Cook especially has spent the last 15, 20 years building up this really great supply chain, and it worked great until it didn't.
Right. Free, once now once free movement of stuff, whether it's because of viruses or trade wars or whatever, it's all strength until it's a weakness. But I just hope that maybe this will give some companies some thought that remote culture and work from home culture is also a hardened, resilient culture for situations like this. Like Macworld back in the day, and certainly Six Colors and Relay and The Incomparable and all these places that are just totally virtual. But Macworld back in the day, like almost all of us could just not come in and do our jobs. And it wasn't always the case. There were exceptions. And like I said, not everybody can work at home, but like the idea that you're flexible like that and that you have remote people, we have the technology has grown. It's so much better. But I think the people who make the decisions are also older. And so they're less inclined to embrace new technology. Like, I feel like I've been living my life with online relationships since I was in high school, essentially. And it doesn't seem weird to me at all. But I was an outlier, which means that the people my age, Gen X people who are in charge of these decisions and older, baby boomers, don't get it, really. And that means there's a younger generation that I think is totally receptive to it, but they're not the ones necessarily in power. And also the senior people, again, Apple spent billions of dollars building Apple Park, right? Like, they want their people there. They believe that the best thing is for the key core people at Apple to be in that campus.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you go against that? It's hard, but I think it would make them better if they went against it a little bit more.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And, you know, to put back to that podcast Anthony and I recorded, he asked me at one point about making the transition from like, oh, you were a journalist working in office to like somebody working at home. I was like, I never worked in an office. And in fact, I have not worked in an office. My last office job I left in 2005. So I have not worked in an office in 15 years.
Yeah.
And in my adult post-college life, I only worked in an office for 2.5 years out of 17.
Yeah.
Like, this is the norm for me. And it is like, you know, it comes with its attendant challenges and stuff like you're discussing.
For sure.
Not everyone can do it and not every job is suited to it. But there are a lot more places that are than people want to admit.
That's it.
And I think it's about not necessarily like we're not suggesting everybody should make everybody work at home. Right.
No.
We're suggesting the option.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The option, and also like,
give the option,
and let people do remote work if it's a job that remote work is possible. Like James Thompson, really, literally, did not need to be in Cupertino to write the doc for OS X. Like he didn't. But Steve Jobs wanted him there because he felt, and I know that some people, the reason that I'm not sure whether I want to write this or not is some people really disagree with this. Some people really strongly feel that having a bunch of people in the same space is magic because they rub up against each other and they, you know, which is cause static electricity, I say, but they say, no, it's good. They're eating at the same cafeteria. They're able to, you know, walk around at Apple Park. They can walk around that lake or whatever. Right. And that it's magic. It's collaborative and all of that. And part of this is my bias as a writer and editor, but most of our jobs, I mean, when we had an open office plan at the end, like everybody just puts on headphones and doesn't talk to anybody because they're doing their job, which requires intense focus. Programmers need to focus intensely most of the time. And I would argue that although you may miss some serendipity by the, you know, candy machine or the refrigerator or in line for a bagel, you can pick up a lot of conversation in a Slack kind of environment or a Zoom teleconference. And I think I think it is, there are a lot of jobs where it's not necessary and you could get better people if you could expand. And I guess in the end, that's all I'm really saying is I hope this crisis exposes some of those policies and makes people rethink them, because I think it would be not only taking a positive out of this crisis, but maybe making some cultural changes that were good. Thinking of WWDC as something that's truly accessible for all instead of something that is a very expensive conference that only a certain strata of developers can attend. Again, I would like to see, even if we go back to sort of the way it was, I'd like there to be some change, because it could probably stand to change, as fun as it is. And maybe this is a prompt to make changes culturally.
I mean, there is, when you have to deal and react to these kinds of large scale challenges, you know, there is the old adapt or die saying, right? Like, and I think that's probably part of it, even if it does end up, as you say, like going back to normal, because next year we're not dealing with this particular situation. There's an opportunity to learn from this and to change. And those opportunities don't come along very often, because most of the time people are pretty happy to just keep doing what they're doing. It works fine. Like, what's the problem, right? Like, until they're forced to think about something and confront it and think, you know, oh, what if we did do this differently? Like, what would that look like? How could we change this? What improvements would that bring, right? Like, I think that is, if you can get people energized thinking about that aspect of it, like, well, let's take this chance since we don't have to throw a large, you know, event with thousands of people and rent out a big convention center and all this stuff, like maybe we devote the time that we would have spent to prepping for that to figuring out what is this going to look like and how can we make changes in the future.
Yeah,
not that I'm in charge of anything or anybody should put me in charge of anything. But yeah, I mean, yeah,
it will be interesting. Yeah, I hope it causes people to rethink things, and I think sometimes it just has to be one of those moments where somebody goes, we can do it this way. This was fine. I didn't realize that this was fine. But you know, I don't know. I'm definitely I'm the guy who went to our CFO at IDG and said, "Have you considered not having an office for editorial?" I actually said that. I said we could have an office for the lab and some hot desk, you know, spaces, hot swap mm-hmm. desk spaces for people who wanted to come in, and then we could give everybody a reimbursement benefit for a co-working space if they wanted. We could offer to buy them a seat at a co-working space of their choice. Or do an ergonomic evaluation of their home office space or something like that. We could really do this and then
pay for my coffee every day.
Yeah, and not spend, or tea, whatever. Not spend that money on South of Market San Francisco real estate. And sure. The answer was, well, no. Okay. All right.
Well, I asked.
I did what I could, is what I'm saying. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's yeah. Interesting.
I do think it can be. I mean, we've seen it. Like, what was it? Somebody. Panzerino. Matthew Panzerino, who's the editor in chief at TechCrunch, was pointing out that they run a distributed
sure, yeah.
newsroom.
Why wouldn't you?
And it's fine. Like, it's
Jason,
fine.
I'm loathe to submit it, but I think we should consider shutting down the Six Colors newsroom. I mean, it is expensive.
Everybody, attention, all employees of the Incomparable Incorporated, you are now working from home until further notice, as you have been up to now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the lab is really the biggest casualty there.
I feel really bad about, like, not everybody can work from home, and I think that's the other story here, is that everybody's like, oh, hunker down, we'll let this thing pass over us. It's like, yeah, except for all those people who can't do that, because
Right, and I mean, the worst being the situations with, you know, people have talked a lot about this on Twitter, but, like, people work in, say, the food service industry, which traditionally has terrible benefits, and you can't take sick days.
Yeah, and they're going to get furloughed, because stuff's going to stop being, you know...
There's no customers.
Yeah, there are a lot of airport jobs and stadium jobs and stuff like that. I mean, if they... Mm-hmm. If this really gets extreme, which it might, for good reason, like... The good reason, by the way, as it's been explained to me, which I think is really smart and not entirely obvious, is people are going to get sick, but what you want is to make the transmission take as long as possible.
Right.
Because that
smooths
out the peak of the wave. And what we really don't want to have happen is the hospitals to get overwhelmed.
Right.
Because
exactly. You don't want like 100,000, 200,000 people all at the same exact time.
So you keep people apart, not because you think that it's going to solve this and nobody's going to get sick, because people are going to get sick. Yep. That's going to happen.
Yeah,
it's spreading around the world. But what you want to do is slow it as much as possible so fewer people get sick. And when they get sick later so that there's a hospital bed for them if they need it, so that they don't die, basically.
Yep.
Yeah.
Boy.
I'm going to miss people at WWDC. It's going to be sad. I hope they do an event just so that I can go, because I'm local. I'll just drive down. I don't even need to fly. I'll just go. I'll show up.
I am sad because, I don't think I've publicly announced this, but I had enough of my panelists drop out from the Live Inconceivable show that is definitely not happening.
Take your stuff and do it as a you can do that remotely. That's a work from home inconceivable.
Absolutely,
now.
I probably will. I mean, I'll be I'll repurpose that. Yeah. But it's sad because I was looking forward to going out to Seattle, and there are people I only get to see there once or twice a year, and. I don't know when that's going to happen again. Will there be one next year? Who knows? That's the other question with a lot of these conferences that are not like put on by, giant tech companies is people don't show up for a year or they have to cancel.
Yeah.
Who knows what the financial impact of that is?
Costs and
does it put
that.
Them out of business? It may. I know our friend Jesse Char, who runs the Layers Conference, has been talking a lot about this on Twitter. Because, that's a smaller independent conference, not a conference that's put on by a giant company. Like, I was going to Emerald City Comic Con. It's put on by Reed Pop, which is a giant company that's job is putting on exhibitions, Comic Cons and the Star Wars Con and all that stuff. They are a big business. If they have to cancel one, it would hurt them, but I don't think it would put them out of business. But if you're just running, a small independent conference, that's tough, right? Like, that is a tough thing to do. It's not something that necessarily you can just walk away from.
Yeah. Uncharted territory in a lot of ways. I was reading a story about the Spanish flu pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100 years ago.
100 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And the thought now is that a lot of that was due to malnutrition and bad medical care and things like that. That it was that we're in a better position to deal with it. But you can also see, I was looking at these reports and remembering The Stand by Stephen King and thinking, it's we are still not prepared for this. So maybe this will be a blessing and this will teach us some lessons that we'll learn and that if there's a next one of these, we'll be better prepared. But it's very clear that you can see how so many different organizations have mishandled this. And we've known that something like this was coming for a long time.
Sure.
There was a little bit of one in 2009 with the swine flu, but still you see an inability to respond quickly. It's like people are figuring it out instead of having already planned it, which I know they have, but it didn't work.
I think a lot of it is people just don't because it's something that occurs only every once in a while. Even if you know it could happen, people get complacent, right? And people say, I don't want to think about that. Like, that seems, or I don't we'll prepare for this thing that there's a small chance it might happen. Like, I think people are very good at, kind of triaging out, for better or worse, things that are not immediate concerns. And especially if you're someone with a lot of concerns about, like, I'm worried about paying my bills. And, I'm an organization that's worried about, keeping my staff and getting income and, dealing with all the day-to-day problems. You don't always think out long term, right? People are not always the best at that. So it's not surprising to me that this is the situation in which we find ourselves. I would have honestly been a lot more surprised if it seemed like, yeah, we're totally prepared for this, we're ready, here's our plan, and we're good to go, right? Like, that would have kind of shocked me, because I don't think any organization is that efficient.
Yeah.
But you're right, like, until it happens, you're not going to actually consider it. I mean, you live in a place where earthquakes are frequent, and, like, obviously people plan for that kind of thing, and you build structures to prepare for that and the like. But, like, people weren't doing that as much prior to the first, I was thinking back to, was it 1908 or three, the big
1908,
one?
1908, like, I think.
People really didn't think about it. And then, like, you had a giant earthquake and a lot of the town burned down and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, we should probably plan for that because we live in a place where this might happen. And it still happens. But
1906, by the way, 06.
06, thank you. And certainly the devastation, I think, in most cases is not as bad now. Like, even it's still, there's still bad, like the one that happened back in the 80s, it's still bad things happen and people die and bridges break and all that. But, like, it's not quite the level that it was, because you knew it was something that could happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then you read the articles that are like, Seattle, and here's what happens if there's a giant earthquake in that fault line under Seattle or whatever. And those people are not ready for that. There's a lot of other places where people are not prepared for that kind of thing because it hasn't happened yet.
Yep, it's true. And it's so easy to just think, well, it won't happen, so we just
won't happen
deal with
today
it.
I won't worry about it,
and here we are. So people should go watch Counterpart if they haven't. It's available on Amazon Prime Video in the U.S. now.
And yeah, no, boy, no, have I no been
reason
about that.
No reason. There's a virus that factors in there. So that's all. I'm out of tea, Dan. So I think this is over.
Same.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week with more shenanigans and nonsense and travel destination stories and tales of tea and other topics. Plus also, Apple, whatever. Sure.
Probably that.
Probably. Unless it's canceled.
Forever. Is Apple canceled yet?
Oh.
It's my new site.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to that.
It's very small.
It just says no.
It just says
it's
no.
Fine.
That's true.
All right. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.